Good evening and welcome to Netherlands Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington. Today is Saturday, February 18th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Africa heads of state convene in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, this weekend for the annual African Union Summit. Renewed clashes over a territorial dispute in Somalia sends more than 60,000 Somalis fleeing to Ethiopia's Somali region.
Families have temporarily settled across more than 13 locations in the Dolo Zone in Ethiopia's Somali region, which is an extremely remote area with a limited humanitarian presence.
And a growing number of early and forced marriages have been reported in South Sudan.
Girls face child labor. As you move around Juba City, you find very many children trying to survive, to sustain their lives, selling bananas. And so you may find a child of 10 years selling bananas, which is not good because they don't have actually access to good life.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Heads of state are in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, this weekend for the annual African Union Summit. In addition to leaders from the 55 AU member states, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres and European Council President Charles Michel will attend the summit. Reuters news agency reports that deepening security and food crises are likely to dominate the agenda. Armed conflict from West Africa's Sahel to the Horn of Africa in the east, and the impacts of droughts and floods have driven ever more Africans from their homes, according to the United Nations figures. According to Reuters, AU Peace and Security Commissioner Bankole Adeoye is expected to try to rally support for a proposal for new financing of security operations from the United States, African Union members, and the European Union. Financing has been a perennial challenge for AU initiatives like its peacekeeping mission in Somalia. In 2020, the AU postponed plans to start financing security operations from a new fund until 2023 because it had received less than half of the targeted $400 million.
Earlier, I reached Maya Miskil, who is at the summit in Addis Ababa, for more about the summit. Hi, Maya. What's going on right now?
The summit is going well. Today there was the opening session here in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. It's very lively, numerous heads of state present here from across the continent. Heads of state like President Kagame of Rwanda and Ramaphosa of South Africa, who were not present at last year's summit, are here this year. So it's a very lively event.
How is the attendance, as far as you know?
Well, missing from the heads of state is the Ugandan president, Museveni, as well as Egyptian president, El-Sisi. However, they're both represented instead by their country's vice president and foreign minister, respectively. But other than that, there are presidents of DRC, Algeria, Morocco, Madagascar, Djibouti, Somalia, Senegal. It's a lot of heads of state who have gathered here today for the opening.
And from what you're gathering, what are the sticking issues? What's the main agenda of this summit?
So this year's AU Assembly, the theme of the Assembly is the year of the AfCFTA and acceleration of this of the African Continental Free Trade implementation. And today's session, with the closed session that took place right after the opening ceremony, was focused on the adoption of the draft agenda of the Executive Council. So that is what took place today. There were also side conferences. There have been side conferences happening on the sidelines here at the AU. For instance, today, about an hour ago, there was one with the UN Secretary General as well. Other than that, what I would say is there were a lot of things that were mentioned repeatedly at the opening speeches, including how Africa is underrepresented at the Security Council, how there is an immense need for debt restructuring, and as well as consideration of a just transition whenever the African Union is talking about renewable energy, to ensure that just transition into renewable energy.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports and renewed clashes over a territorial dispute in Somalia has sent more than 60,000 Somalis fleeing to Ethiopia's Somali region in the past few weeks. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Heavy fighting erupted in the city of Las Canod in the disputed Sole region of Somalia in January, sending thousands fleeing for their lives. A flare-up of deadly clashes early this month has caused thousands more to abandon their homes. The UN Refugee Agency reports more than half of the 60,000 refugees arrived in Ethiopia earlier this week. UNHCR spokeswoman Olga Sarado says the refugees, mainly women and children, have arrived exhausted, traumatized, and with few belongings. She says they fled in a hurry and took only what they could carry. Sarado also says the refugees told UN staff they had to sell their belongings to pay for transportation to reach safety.
Many of them have lost loved ones in the clashes or have separated during flight. Families have temporarily settled across more than 13 locations in the Dolo zone in Ethiopia-Somali region, which is an extremely remote area with a limited humanitarian presence. And local communities in Dolo have generously welcomed these refugees, sharing whatever resources they have, which are very, very little.
Sole is an administrative region in the east part of Somaliland. The fighting reportedly was triggered in January when Dulbahante clan elders declared they no longer were part of Somaliland and that Sole now was governed by the Somali authorities. UN agencies report renewed clashes that began on February 5th between the security forces and clan members in Las Canod have killed at least 20 people, injured an estimated 119, and displaced more than 185,000. Serrato says an average of 1,000 people are crossing into Ethiopia every day. She says they are arriving in some of the worst drought-hit areas in the region and that resources are seriously overstretched following 5 years of failed rains. This makes it difficult for people in the area to support themselves, let alone thousands of others.
And with limited options, many newly arrived refugee families have resorted to sheltering in schools and other public buildings, while others have no choice but to sleep outside. Many urgently need food and nutritional support, water and sanitation facilities, as well as specialized support for people with specific needs.
Sarado says the UNHCR is working with Ethiopian authorities, UN and non-governmental partners to set up temporary reception centers and provide immediate aid. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In less than a week, Africa's largest democracy will hold its sixth election since the return to civilian leadership in 1999. For a preview of the elections, VOA's Encounter host, Caro Castiel, talked to Peter Lewis, professor of African studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Ebenezer Obadere, senior fellow in African studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. They discussed what's at stake in the upcoming Nigerian presidential and parliamentary elections and whether insurgent Labour Party candidate Peter Obi can mobilize his supporters, defy the odds, and emerge victorious.
Well, it's really a crucial time for Nigerians. As you note, it's the most populous country on the continent and the largest economy. And Nigerians have certainly expressed recently a very somber mood. There have been two major recessions in the last 8 years, the most recent precipitated by the COVID pandemic, downturn in oil prices and inconsistent economic policies. And perhaps even more concerning is the downward spiral in the security situation domestically. Multiple insurgencies, violence between herders and farmers, as you referenced in the introduction, widespread banditry and crime really spanning the entire territory, and local communal violence. And so Nigerians have expressed a great deal of pessimism about the direction of the country and a great deal of concern about problems of governance. In the most recent Afrobarometer survey conducted in the country less than a year ago, 90% of Nigerians said the country is going in the wrong direction, and presidential approval ratings were at an all-time low. So this just gives us a sense of the problems and the frustrations that citizens are expressing, and also the possibility of and hopes for a change in the election.
Turning to you, Ebenezer Obadere, so hope for change, given the deteriorating security situation, the downturn in oil prices, the COVID pandemic repercussions, what are your views with regard to what's at stake in this election?
Thank you for the question. Just like previous elections, everything is at stake. Questions of governance are at stake. Corruption is at stake. The quality of the political elite, the political process in its entirety, regionalism, problems of restructuring, security, the economy itself, youth angst. There's a sense in which because Nigeria has not definitively resolved, let alone come to terms with many of these problems, there's a sense in which they get rolled over. And what that means is that every election, at least since 1999, when the country became a democracy again after a long military interregnum, it means that every election is more or less a referendum on all the major issues at stake in the Nigerian political process. Everything is at stake. And I can predict from where I'm sitting right now that if things don't change, the next election in 4 years will also be about the same set of issues that we are talking about right now.
VOA's Encounter host, Caro Castiel, talking with Peter Lewis, Professor of African Studies at Johns Hopkins University, and Ebenezer Obadere, Senior Fellow in African Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. The entire program can be heard on Encounter later Saturday and Sunday. VOA.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 202-258-3076.
Reuters says inflation-stricken Egyptians are flocking to Ahlan, or welcome, markets that have opened 3 months ahead of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The markets offer basic commodities at cheaper prices than shops, including discounts of up to 30% on flour, meat, and pasta consumed between fasting. Egyptian authorities say the scheme will last until the end of April. The spending power of consumers has plummeted in recent months as Egypt copes with inflation, a dollar shortage, and years of austerity. There is mounting pressure on the Ugandan government to reverse its decision to close the United Nations local human rights office. The government has drawn strong criticism from opposition leaders and activists who say it highlights the country's worsening record on civil liberties. The government told the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights last week that it would not renew the mandate of its office in the East African country, effectively expelling the rights monitors. Charles Mwangu Hyampagi is a political analyst and TV host. He tells me that the Ugandan government is not likely to relent to local pressure.
Well, government says it's just not sending the United Nations Human Rights Office out of the country, has only decided and notified that office that it will not be renewing the agreement they signed, which was renewable every 3 years since the UN Human Rights Office set up in Kampala. There has been a lot of negative response, especially from civil society actors and human rights actors in the country. But government has stood its ground and said the human rights situation in the country is not any bad. It is not bad, and it has established institutions that are capable of defending and looking out and holding government account. The challenge is that the UN Human Rights Office was actually supporting the government institutions in building their own human rights system over the years that have been around. And that is still out there subject to discussion. We haven't heard much from the United Nations in that response to this decision by their host country, the government of Uganda, not to renew the agreement.
The pressure from mainly opposition groups and other civil rights groups, would the government take into consideration that those demands, or do you think the government may ignore? I remember.
Unlikely that government will bow to domestic pressure. Normally, how things like these relationships play out in the international arena is what would shape the government's response. Domestic pressure, especially on the question of an office that government thinks has built its own capacity, the government claims it invited the UN Human Rights Office to set up in Kampala in 2006, likely to lead to the kind of pressure that forces government to rescind its position on that. Normally what it has done is that it will keep quiet and work its international diplomacy in a different way, and you see something else, some kind of engagement with these international bodies emerge that kind of distracts from what was from the decision it has made for now.
The government in its letter to the UN said that now Uganda has enough capacity and their fundamentals for making sure their human rights are observed. From what you hear from around the country, how is the situation like as far as human rights are concerned?
It's an interesting time. It's an interesting coincidence because discussion and the debate among the populace about the state of human rights in the country is at a peak. Allegations against state security agencies of abductions, which government has insisted are not abductions, but arrests being carried out by state security agencies, talk about people disappearing and government saying no. The exaggerations, especially from the opposition political parties, about what people they allege have either disappeared or have been abducted, and emergence of images that are quite horrific. We just reeling with recent revelations by a gentleman who says he was abducted, held in detention in an unknown facility, and then imagined with what appears to be burn marks, the hot object, just on his chest on both sides. And the UNA, for example, issuing a statement and saying, we have consulted with other security agencies and checked, and we haven't found a record of this man being in any of our facilities. So he should explain where he got tortured from. And then accusations by political actors, especially on the government side, saying that some of these are being staged by the political opposition to tarnish the image of government. So the ping-pong between the government and the political opposition and the apparent helplessness of civil society and the media to probe and investigate exactly what is going on is something that Ugandans are watching, and difficult to tell who is right, who is wrong. Incidents are seen happening. There have been some, there's been, of course, condemnation, but the voices of condemnation are not as strong, and denials from government, and it's difficult to tell exactly who is telling the truth and who is not.
That was Charles Mwanguhia Mpagi, a political analyst and TV host. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Ghanaian footballer Christian Asu has been found dead under the building where he lived in southern Turkey after last week's massive earthquake, according to his agent. Asu's body was found under the rubble in Hatay. His phone was also found. Asu played for Chelsea, Newcastle, Everton and Bournemouth in the English Premier League before joining Turkish club Hatayspor in September of 2022. Asu also played on Ghana's World Cup team in 2014. He won 65 caps for Ghana and helped his country reach the 2015 Africa Cup of Nations final, where they lost to Ivory Coast on penalties. Asu had been scheduled to fly out of southern Turkey hours before the quake, but Hatayspor's manager said on Friday the Ghanaian opted to stay with the club after scoring the game-winning goal in a February 5th Super League match. A Kenyan government operation to disarm warring parties in the troubled Rift Valley region is off to a slow start. Media reports say a three-day amnesty period for people to turn in illegal weapons resulted in the handover of just three guns. Kenyan police did arrest a local lawmaker for allegedly funding bandits and cattle rustlers who have wreaked havoc in the region. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
A Kenyan government operation to disarm warring parties in the troubled Rift Valley region is off to a slow start. Media reports say a three-day amnesty period for people to hand in illegal weapons resulted in the handover of just three guns. Kenyan police did arrest a local lawmaker for allegedly funding bandits and cattle rustlers who have wreaked havoc in the region. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi. Text. Kenyan government forces launched an operation this week to crack down on chronic violence in the Rift Valley. Most of the fighting is between communities over grazing land and livestock made worse by the ongoing severe drought. The first step, a three-day amnesty for people to hand over illegal weapons, resulted in just three guns being turned in by Thursday evening. Police and regional officials declined to respond to VOA requests for comment. Kenyan security analyst George Musamali says the communities in the North Rift Valley region cannot give up their guns easily after decades of insecurity in the region.
It went in with threats. And basically, if you look at these communities, these are communities that have been taking care of their own security. I mean, they don't see government there. They would rather keep the guns until the operation is over. And then when the security forces leave the area, then they can continue living the way they are used to living because the government is not offering any solutions to the perennial security problems in those areas.
A security operation aimed at disarming the communities began Friday after the end of the amnesty period. On Thursday, officers from the Kenya's Department of Investigation Unit arrested a Pokot South Member of Parliament, David Kosing, for allegedly financing the banditry in West Pokot County. The legislator was later released and denied the claims of supporting the bandits. Danson Omari is a lawyer representing Kosing. He says his client will appear at the offices of the Criminal Investigation Unit to respond to more questions about his source of wealth.
We agreed that he will take him there at 4 p.m. today so that he can respond to those allegations because we were told they have expanded the investigation. Now they want us to respond to the allegations that the Member of Parliament is involved in money laundering. That the chopper, the helicopter that he has, they'll want to go and take a photo of the helicopter. And lastly, that they want to see how he has benefited from the banditry, the commercial aspect of banditry.
Kosing told VOA some politicians from rival communities closer to the government were inciting authorities against him and his community. He says the government needs to create a program where the warring communities can feed and move their animals freely in the region.
We have given the government to approach it in a structural manner. Let us allow the Turkanas, let us allow the Samburus, let us allow the Pokots, the Marakwets, the entire of these places where it is this distance. Let us bring order in terms of access to grass and water. If there is order, my brother, there's no conflict at all. But for now, there is no government.
The communities in Baringo, West Pokot, Elegeyo Marakwet, Samburu, Laikipia and Turkana have been stealing animals from each other, leading to communal tensions and conflict. Experts are urging the government to change its approach to dealing with the banditry threat and begin improving the lives of the communities by constructing roads, schools and water points, as well as encouraging the community to start farming as another source of income. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, a prominent traditional leader is expressing hope that peace will soon return to the troubled Kwamoth territory following months of fighting between communities. The conflict between the Taka and Yaka peoples over land disputes forced thousands to flee their homes. But local reports say more than 1,000 armed combatants have decided to lay down their weapons following peace efforts by traditional chiefs led by the Grand Suku chief, Mini Congo Fabrice Kavabioko. This after President Felix Tshisekedi tasked the traditional leaders to find solutions to the conflict. For more about efforts to resolve the conflict between the Yaka and Taka communities, VOA's Peter Klote reached King Mimi Congo Fabrice Kababioko.
We went to visit the president, me and my chief of my kingdom, and the president asked us if we can help him to go and stop the war between the two tribes, the one they was fighting in Kwamoto. So for me, my president, he was not feel well. He was not, he cannot see two tribes to fight. And that was the reason, like it was a tribe fighting. And the president, he preferred to send us as a king and the chiefs to go and stop that fight.
What efforts have you made in terms of trying to find solutions to the ongoing conflict in the Kwamutu region?
We went and tried to make a two tribe people together because their conflict was about the land. It was a problem between a farmer people. For me, I went to talk to those other tribe called Yaka, the one they are fighting with Teke. And I went to talk to Yaka, the chief of Yaka. The chief of Yaka, they helped me to went. I went with them to Teke land in Kwamutu. And we talked now the boys who they was in the bush, who they was fighting with the Teke. And from there, we didn't understand with them. They gave me back all the weapon and the things they was fighting with. The knife and all this, they start now giving back to me, and we are start now bringing them back, bringing them out of the bush where they was fighting with the Teke, and we are trying now to bring them to Kinshasa, and the government, they know what to do with those boys. Yeah, so for now I can say I try already to make peace, like 18% is back. People start now coming back to their land, to their villages, yeah, because of us commissioning the one the president put on the place.
What has been the reaction of these two groups of people after you made overtures to them?
I think their reaction is good, because when two people are fighting, number three, he came to bring the peace. They have to receive him. So I think the other tribe who called Yaka, who they was stronger more than Teke, because the Yaka, they was fighting with Teke. And when Teke ran away, now the Yaka, they start fighting with the soldiers. But when I went there, I tried to talk to this Yaka to stop fighting with our army. And they listened to me. They believe of what message I brought to them, the one who will be coming to the president. And they start giving back their weapon to saying it's no more war. They want to stop fighting. Yes.
With what you have seen so far, how soon do you think peace could return to the region? And have you informed the president about these efforts and what are his expectations so far?
Yes, you know, the peace, you know, when people seek, the seek it come fast, but the person to for the seek to go, the seek always go slowly, slowly. So I'm not alone who the president in charge. The president also in charge the member for government. So, I mean, I'm working, me and the ministers of security of country and the minister of close to the president. So, I mean, everything we as a commissioner we are doing, we are giving the report straight away to these two ministers, and the ministers, they are informing the head of state. I mean, for us, we are fighting to saying the peace it need to come quickly, because you remember we are going to election to our country. We don't need this conflict of try peace. We are working on this 24 hours. We are not sleeping. In my group, we are about 200 chiefs who we are working for to bring peace in the region. So, I mean, very soon everything is going to be okay. But I think 85% already of peace, because people, when they was fighting, the people was running away, all of them, in the villages. But like now we are talking, people are back already.
That was the Grand Suku Chief King Mimini Kongo Fabrice Kavabioko speaking with my colleague Peter Klote. Listening to the Voice of America, and this is Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from across the continent. But first, in South Sudan, the legal age of marriage is 18. However, since independence in 2011, early and forced marriages have been reported in Africa's newest nation. James Shimanyula takes up the story.
By some estimates, nearly half of all girls in South Sudan marry before the age of 18. A report from Human Rights Watch says dowry often leads families to force their girls to marry as early as possible, frequently after first menstruation. Randa Wani, aged 18, explains why early marriages happen.
Girls face child labor. As you move around in Juba City, you find very many children trying to survive, to sustain their lives, selling bananas. And so you may find a child of 10 years selling bananas, which is not good because they don't have actually access to good life. So they are forced to move on the streets so that they can sustain their life. We also have children on drugs, those street kids, those ones who are orphans. There is no any good care that is taken of them. They're just living very useless life.
Randa thinks girls should not marry in their teens.
The right age for marriage is supposed to be 25. This is for the case of the girls and 30 for the case of the boys. But here in South Sudan, it's a different story because we find girls of 16, 15 getting married to old men. Like, you can be here in the city, but your father and your mother in the village planning. They're already making ways of how you can meet your man in the village, which is not right.
17-year-old Achel Atem worries about the effects of early marriage on schooling.
The young girls are getting married, it's not yet their time. And also, the education in the country is not that up to date. So we, the children, are not having the access to education.
20-year-old Johnston Koang explains why he thinks so many girls marry early.
Children are getting married because of the poverty of the country. These days, children are not stable. Most of them are not in good education centers. That's why you are seeing a child of 16 years getting married to a man who is older than her.
The United Nations Children's Fund says South Sudan has the seventh highest prevalence rate of child marriage in the world. According to UNICEF, 52% of girls in South Sudan are married before their 18th birthday and 9% marry before reaching 15. Child marriage is widely considered a violation of human rights and a form of violence against girls. The elimination of child marriage by 2030 is one of the International Sustainable Development Goals. For VOA, I'm James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
A group of political and civil society and traditional leaders from eastern Sudan are calling for the immediate formation of a civilian-led government in Sudan responsible for addressing the concerns and grievances of citizens in that part of the country. The call came at the end of a conference held in Khartoum. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The four-day conference wrapped up in the Sudanese capital Khartoum Wednesday evening after a lengthy discussion on restoring political stability, security and sustainable development in eastern Sudan. Participants also explored opportunities to reach a broad consensus between the various entities and organizations in eastern Sudan. Some conference goers said government policy has often been used against the people of eastern Sudan despite being rich in natural and environmental resources. They said eastern Sudan continues to suffer from instability and security threats, widespread poverty and successive famines. Speaking to reporters minutes after the final ceremony, Mariama Sadiq al-Mahdi, a leader of the Umma National Party, says conference resolutions should be regarded as the basis for a development program in eastern Sudan.
It is a strategic location with vast natural resources, including renewable and non-renewable wealth. For years, eastern Sudan has been a point of ambitions for many internal and external forces. Particularly during the past 30 years, there has been a lot of exploitation of the resources in the area.
The Juba Peace Agreement signed in October 2020 stipulates in its Eastern Track Protocol that development projects and investment should be encouraged in the area. A group from the Bija community of Eastern Sudan rejected the track and called for its suspension, saying the people who signed the agreement do not represent the people of Eastern Sudan. Al-Mahdi says the people of Eastern Sudan should be allowed to speak for themselves.
It is time for us to allow the people of Eastern Sudan to speak out and say what they want. It is time for political and civil activists and the military alike to stop the claim of speaking on behalf of the people of Eastern Sudan.
Speaking to South Sudan in Focus from Kassala town of Eastern Sudan via a messaging application Thursday, Abdullah Obshar, a spokesperson of the Bija High Council, distanced the council from the Khartoum conference.
These resolutions will not address any issue in eastern Sudan. All signatories to the political framework agreement, the military, and the trilateral mechanism should know that our gravness at the moment is to suspend the eastern track and create a new environment for a political process in Sudan.
The Bija High Council had earlier demanded it be included in any discussion on the people of Eastern Sudan and called for a new negotiations with the government on issues related to development in the area. Obshar says the council will only participate in dialogue if the eastern track of the Juba Peace Agreement is called off.
The eastern track is the main cause of the recent crisis in eastern Sudan. Therefore, we request for a new and inclusive negotiation forum.
In December 2021, South Sudan's chief negotiator in the Juba peace talks, Tut Gatluak, announced the suspension of the eastern track. Gatluak said, upon reviewing the agreement with all signatories, they found the eastern track had not been implemented due to concerns raised by the Bija community. Participants in this week's conference emphasized the rights of victims and the family members of victims of gross human rights violations perpetrated by government forces and military leaders in eastern Sudan. They said those rights must be recognized and perpetrators of past crimes must be brought to justice. Michael Atit for VOA News, Khartoum.
And it's now time for our Saturday Music Sport. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
Aye. It's the multi-talented. Again. Just trust in me. I built you a masterpiece. This world not enough for me. Me and the trees sing my for me. Oh, close company. Energy feel no punch on me. Yeah. This luxury. I be DJ somebody. Yeah. Oh, the mommy's on a hijab. T-shirt off white glove. Abu Dhabi photo. For me, two girls, not enough for me. Three girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Not enough for me. Four girls, not enough for me. Five girls, not enough for me. Six girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Nah, nah. I pull up in a Tonka truck. You either get bust around or bust up. What's in the briefcase? The rents are dollars. Don't be a cheap date. Let's pop the bottles. Lames in a sec and I'm blaming the net. Let's do the money dance. One die for a fade. Keep it in the fam and cut my closet. The pillows in the air, it's soft, it's moisture. Never a defense to block the solar. Pasta Mary Jane, this world my oyster. Yeah. Los Angeles. Give me more ambience. BBC One smoking. It's international motion. Let me do my dance. Let me count my bands. I'm thinking of a master plan. Reprogram, reset. Stay focused, revenge. Until then, foot on neck. Just trust in me. I built you a masterpiece. This world not enough for me. Kiss me in the tree, sing my for me. Oh, close company. Energy feel no punch on me. Yeah. This luxury. I be DJ somebody. Yeah. Oh, the mommy's on a hijab. T-shirt off white glove. Abu Dhabi photo. Enough for me. Two girls, not enough for me. Three girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Not enough for me. Four girls, not enough for me. Five girls, not enough for me. Six girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Nah, nah. Enough for me. Two girls, not enough for me. Three girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Not enough for me. Four girls, not enough for me. Five girls, not enough for me. Six girls, not enough for me. Not enough for me. Nah, nah.
Summer. like summertime. You make the body go.
Oh, missing one when I'm gone. Why na 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 na? Magic. In my wire, all over you to find. Put your banana like monkey, body sweeter than turkey. Slowly roll it down like those feet. No, they take on far from me. Shorty go down, down for me. Waiting go so far, now money. Girl, nobody's all on me. Your two, your enter for me.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. From the rest of the Nightline Africa team, I thank you for joining us tonight, and please join us tomorrow Sunday. I'm Douglas Impoga. Have a very good evening.